All right. Good morning, Laguna Beach, California. We're a few minutes behind schedule here. We were playing some music. This is what we call delay, so we can set up some cameras and get ready for our guest this morning, who is we'll talk about in a very brief period of time. I'm Scott Hayes. This, of course, is Radio Caravan, and I'm here with my co-host, Robert Palmer.
Good morning, Scooty. How you doing?
Scooty, how many times do we have to have that conversation?
I don't know. I love Scooty.
It comes naturally for you, I guess, yes?
It does indeed.
Hey, in the studio today, we've got engineer Brian Holst, of course. Nice to see you, Brian. Good morning, sir. You're doing a nice job so far?
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me in this morning.
Excellent.
Thank you for being had.
He's being had, and April in the background there. And, of course, we have the Sparkle Film crew, Corey, Cyrus, Nick. We've got B-roll man Harvey out there. And we wanted to give a couple of shout-outs this morning. We wanted to shout out to one of our dedicated listeners, Rebecca from Florida. Robert, anything you want to say to Rebecca from Florida?
No, good to talk to you.
Okay.
Take care, sis. And we got Larry from Laguna. We got Big Brian, and we got Puppers listening this morning as well.
Puppers. Well, that's interesting. And in South Carolina, we have some new fans, by the way. We have Mimi, who's out there, and she's staying at a beach house, I believe, with Jim and Betty and Dale and Lisa, who got engaged last night.
Wow, that's quite a group you got out there.
Yeah, there's quite a group, so I'm glad they're listening. So, hey, let's go with a little bit of our famous early mornings police blotter stuff. Are we ready for that? We're ready for that. While we're getting ready, I'm going to talk to you about our guests this morning. We have Tony Tetro coming in, who some have called the world's greatest living art forger. And he's here to discuss what life is like after you've been arrested and imprisoned.
I can't wait.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting show. So, police blotter.
Today's police blotter.
All right, it's another day of cesspool in Laguna Beach. Violence runs everywhere, criminals running rampant, and there's no Batman to stop it. Get a load of some of this. This I call the reading, writing, and arithmetic gang. Tuesday, February 4th, 1400 block, South Coast Highway. Someone chiseled the name Zahide into the side of a house.
Zide?
Zahide.
Zahide.
I think they misspelled something. Weren't the brightest crew. All right, Wednesday, February 5th. A citizen reported a vehicle parked on the side of the street. It was missing the right side of its panel, the right tire, and most of the right side of the car. The police arrested the 18-year-old inside of the car.
Huh.
And when you kind of leave the car at that point...
I would think so.
You've lost your wheel, you've lost half your car. Time to kind of get out of that. But no, he bravely stood by. And my last one, Beavis and Butthead. Sunday, February 9th. Disturbance was called in at the 1400 block of North Coast Highway. Two of three men who were yelling and who had smashed a window in an attempt to reach their unconscious friend were arrested for being under the influence of a stimulant. Their friend, later after police broke into the house, was found unconscious. He, too, was arrested and transported to the hospital.
Wow, I hope he's okay.
So that's just the kind of stuff we've got going out there. So
yeah,
keep the children locked up today.
Yeah, under the influence of stuff that makes you go unconscious doesn't sound like a lot of fun to me.
No, it didn't work out well for Philip Seymour Hoffman either.
Yeah, that's true. That's a sad case right there. Hey, I think on the phone, if we're ready for the phone caller here, we have Max, our San Francisco reporter. Max, are you there? Testing, Max. 1, 2, 3. Well, waiting for Max to come through. We're going to talk about our Max Tech. Is he there? There he is. Hey, Max, how you doing? Doing great, man. And, you know, we're calling you our San Francisco reporter because you're in San Francisco, yes? Beautiful. And you're becoming our sort of tech guru, right? And you...
And you're the owner of Max Tech, are you not?
Yeah. So what do you got for us this morning, Max? are actually fake. You mean fake IDs or fake profiles? Robots. Wow. Well, that's scary. If she's actually a real girlfriend. I'm wondering why, if they know that to be true, why don't they just get rid of those fake profiles and fake IDs? I mean, it would seem like a logical next step, no?
Because the number of users they have drives their revenue
of
that
course.
They can sell their ads for.
Even if they're fake.
That's why they create them.
Ah, Robert, wise person. What else you got for us today, Max?
Toyota recalls 1.9 million Priuses earlier this week because of a software error that can cause the cars to randomly shut off.
Did Toyota agree to keep them and never give them back to the miserable people that drive them?
Well, I don't think this is a big problem because the Priuses move so slow, we won't even notice that they turn off on the road.
That's funny. Are you a bit of a, Robert, are you a bit of a car snob, would you say?
Well, just Priuses.
Oh, just Priuses. Okay.
They don't emit smog, they emit smug.
All right, what else you got, Max?
All right, Dad, do you remember when I mentioned I wanted to be a D1 athlete on scholarship?
I sadly do, and that never happened, as I recall.
Well, you're in luck. One of the largest gaming studios, Blizzard, famous for making World of Warcraft, has announced its funding for competitive gaming at the college level with scholarships.
And you got one?
No, not at all.
Oh,
but
okay.
If you send me the brand new Xbox One, I promise good things will come out of it.
Somehow I think I'm tricked again.
Yeah. All right. Very nice. Very nice. Hey, Max, always a pleasure to listen to you calling in from San Francisco. And, of course, you're spreading the word up there about this radio show, are you not?
I am.
Excellent. And how many listeners do you think we have up there right now?
I mean, we got Yahoo CEO calling in pretty soon. I mean, if Jobs was alive, he'd probably be listening.
All right.
You know, I'll get more, but I probably got about two or three. I got someone with me right now, and then, I'll probably get you about maybe 10, 15 by the end of the week.
That'll double our listenership.
Yeah, that'll be... Hey, Max, thanks for calling in, and hopefully we'll get you for next weekend as well.
Yeah, of course.
I appreciate it, Max. Thanks so much.
Thanks,
man. Have a good one.
Thanks, guys.
All right, we're into our final segment here. Before we take a musical break, and we're going to come back, and we got a good, interesting interview with Tony Tetro, the world's greatest living art forger. But first, we're going to go do a little bit of music, what we like to call rock legend.
Legends of Rock.
Well, I thought before we started today, I would read reviews on their first U.S. performance to give you an idea who we're talking about.
Okay.
Let's start with the L.A. Times. Not even their mothers could claim that they could sing well. William F. Buckley Jr., the Boston Globe. This group was not merely awful. I would consider it sacrilegious to say anything less than they were god-awful. Newsweek, visually and musically a nightmare. Their lyrics are an unmitigated catastrophe. The New York Times, the vocal quality can be described as hoarsely incoherent, with minimal enunciation to barely communicate their text. The Chicago Tribune, must be a huge joke, a wacky joke on America. And finally, the Washington Post, just thinking about them seems to induce a mental disturbance. You know who that group was?
I have no idea.
Well, 50 years ago, last Sunday, on February 7th, 1964, a band called the Beatles got on a plane in the United Kingdom in front of 4,000 people to wish them a fond farewell.
Wow.
Leaving Heathrow and landing later at JFK. 3,000 people greeted them there. And the next day, they made history when they did their first live television performance on The Ed Sullivan Show, watched by over 73 million viewers in 23 million households. An unprecedented 34% of all Americans watched the show. It was the largest audience ever recorded in American history. And this would be the first song they played.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always be true. And then while I'm away, I'll write home every day, and I'll send all my loving to you. I'll pretend.
Robert's doing the twist, by the way.
I was trying to scream like a little girl, but I didn't do it very well. K Capitol Records was, oddly enough, not that interested in them, so United Artists decided to do a three-picture film deal with them. Directed by Richard Lester, their first movie, A Hard Day's Night, came out as a mockumentary of the band. And this, of course, would be the title song from A Hard Day's Night. During the week of April in 1964, this album was so successful that it held 12 positions on the Billboard Hot 1 Singles chart. Indeed, five were top 10 songs. Moving on to 1965, the Beatles began to evolve just a bit, and they released their second film, Help, once again, directed by Richard Lester. This one was described as a relentless spoof on James Bond, including the big hits Help and Ticket to Ride.
Help! I need somebody help, not just anybody help. You know I need someone help. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way.
Perhaps the most important song was one written by one Paul McCartney. Oddly enough, though, years before, Mr. McCartney and Mr. Lennon had reached an agreement that every song either of them ever wrote would be dubbed Lennon and McCartney. Of course, Paul McCartney wrote this song completely on his own, walked into the studio, and had never played it for anyone. He did a single recording for Sir Martin, who absolutely loved it, and added for the first time in rock history a string soundtrack to an accompaniment. Years later, after John had died, Paul went to Yoko and said, I'd like a personal favor. Can we please reverse on this one song only? Lennon and McCartney to McCartney and Lennon. I don't want John's name not on it, but I would like mine to be featured since he had nothing to do with it. Yoko, being the ever lovely, charming, sweet woman that she was, said, screw you. So today, let's hear Yesterday by Lennon and McCartney.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly.
Beautiful song, by the way. Beautiful song.
The most covered song in history. There are over 3,000 versions of that song. Well, Rubber Soul came out next, and after that, they took a new direction again with Revolver, which had a whole new feel to it, lots of studio experimentation, and all new musical styles. One of my favorites off that is another one featuring strings and musical styles, Eleanor Rigby.
Look at all the lovely people. Up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door.
Rapidly evolving, after meeting Bob Dylan and learning what pot was all about, their music got much more psychedelic, if you will. And out they came with their revolutionary album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. One of the most amazing things about this song, if you listen to it, is this entire album is recorded on a four-track recording device. I had one once, a TX machine.
Yeah.
Today, most studios might have 64 or 128 tracks of most of the music you're listening to. This is only four tracks George Martin laid down. Revolutionary.
Which just reminds me that it's always about the song, never the technology.
It is indeed. Although Phil Spector would say his wall of sound is what it's all about.
Yeah, we can talk about that later.
All right, we move on to the White Album, which is kind of their undoing. While making the White Album, the Beatles began very divisive. Indeed, Ringo actually quit for 4 days, leading guess who to play drums on Back in the USSR and Dear Prudence?
Paul McCartney.
Very good. But Harrison and Lennon also joined in to add some. Lennon referred to some of the music as granny music crap, and they began fighting daily.
That's funny.
Says Paul, it was not a pleasant album to make. But the White Album went on to be regarded as one of the finest in history, according to Rolling Stone and many, many others. Well, although Let It Be was their final album, it was largely recorded before they did Abbey Road, which essentially brought them to a close in their history. Lennon became so pissed off at the entire process, he said it was hell. It was miserable, the most miserable thing on earth. Indeed, George Harrison walked off the set for 5 days. He refused to return until they added some musical quality. That musical quality was one Billy Preston, and that's how he winds up playing keyboards on that particular album. But we would be remiss if we didn't mention the two lone Beatles that were never Beatles. That would be Brian Epstein, their manager.
Right.
He was the one that taught them how to dress, taught them never to eat impolitely in public. He created the suits, he created the hair, and he brought them to America. And last but not least is Sir George Martin, their amazing producer who created the entire sound for them. With that, 50 years ago, we take you back to the present, but say goodbye to the Beatles.
That's beautiful, Robert. Thank you. Man, I love those segues, you know, from the musical, historical perspective of one band for about 15 minutes. We're going to listen to Dear Prudence by the Beatles. You're listening to KX93.5 FM. I'm Scott Hayes here with Robert Palmer. This is Radio Caravan. We're going to be back in 60 seconds, and we're going to have in the studio the world's greatest living art forger, Tony Tetro.
Prudence.
Okay, you're listening to KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. I'm Scott Hayes. This is Radio Caravan. And, of course, I'm in the studio today with my co-host, Robert Palmer, who's texting on me.
I am. Good morning.
Who are you texting, by the way? What's going on over there?
One of our listeners.
Oh, very nice. Have them call in. See if they have an interesting question for our next guest. So here's a couple of quotes I'm going to pull on our next guest. Former Los Angeles District Attorney Ira Reiner, who you told me you worked with, right, Robert?
I was a DA for him for 6 weeks.
6 weeks, wow.
But three people in jail, not Tony, though.
All right. Anyways, he said of today's guest, he's the single largest art forger in the United States. The single largest art forger in the United States. Venice Gallery owner Tom Bender said of today's guest, he was just a brilliant mind that went astray, a Frankenstein. And Larry Steinem of the Carol Lawrence Gallery once told the BBC that our next guest, it's one of his paintings is probably in every major museum in the world. They just don't know it yet.
That's right.
Yeah. So in the studio today, we have Tony Tetro, the world's greatest living art forger. Get on the mic, Tony. Get on the mic there. Get as close to that mic as you can, my friend.
Hello.
Pull that closer to you if you want. That way you don't have to reach over.
Why didn't you tell me that before?
Well, I thought we did that, but that's okay. Tony, let me ask you a quick question. If indeed you were the greatest or are the greatest living art forger, how did you end up arrested in 1989? How did you get caught? I mean, you were doing things that nobody, you know, you were like a master full art forger, were you not? You were just raking in the dough. People thought you were they didn't know what sort of business you were in.
Oh, they thought I was a drug dealer, is what they thought.
But you weren't a drug dealer. You were forging famous artworks, right?
Correct.
Is it true that you had a sense of relief when you were finally arrested because you could boldly admit you were not a drug dealer?
That's exactly,
as you said,
true.
Every neighbor and cop thought, but we're a beautiful art forger.
Yes, they had a documentary on after, and they had these cops with their face blacked out, and all these people were going into Tetro's house, and then we thought that it was unusual, and that he must be a drug dealer. And every time a drug dealer got arrested, they call me. I go, hi, how you doing?
Was that you?
Yeah, they were trying to get, you know, wear a wire and come and talk to me.
Oh, wow.
And they all loved me because I got the heat and they didn't.
Yeah, but Tony, ultimately you were arrested for forging artworks, right? And then how did you get caught? Can you just sort of describe briefly?
Do you know?
Yeah, I kind of vaguely remember that you did a Yamaguchi or Yamagata.
Yamagata. For an art dealer.
He was a local artist.
Southern California.
Okay, and what happened there?
No, he is a Southern California artist. He's Japanese, and he was a rising star.
Okay.
Now he's a superstar.
All right.
Because of me, I might add.
Uh-huh, sure.
Well, it was. He got worldwide press over this.
Okay, so what happened?
And this art dealer asked me to do these little watercolors. I'm talking 1 inch by 2 inch, 3 inches by 4 inches, and he'd had some that were 4 inches by 7 inches, something like that. I never saw one in person, but I had a book. And Yamagata was a very, very detailed artist. He could like 20 Japanese characters on a grain of rice, and you had to view it through a magnifying glass.
Wow.
He's very, very detailed. And he had people looking out of windows in villages, and it was a very panoramic view in all of his paintings. And he had balloons with people in the balloons.
So what did you do?
Well, he asked me to copy these. They were watercolors.
Who asked you to copy them?
An art dealer. I don't want to mention his name.
That's fine. No names here. No names today.
Old wounds.
Yeah.
And so I did. That was my job. So I did. I did 40, 50. I forget how many I did for him. And he wrote me a rubber check. I never got paid for him, really.
Right.
And he sold it. Yamagata was under contract with Martin Lawrence Galleries. And there was a gallery right down the street called Carol Lawrence Galleries. And he sells them to them. Now, this is the headquarters for Martin Lawrence, who's nationwide. It's a huge gallery chain.
Yeah.
He sells them to Carol Lawrence Galleries. And Carol Lawrence puts them right in the window.
Wow.
When they're exclusively supposed to be a block away at Martin Lawrence Galleries and their other stores.
And Yamagata walked in one day, saw these paintings in the Carol Lawrence Gallery, and realized when he went back,
that's not mine,
that they aren't his, right?
He's walking with his family down Beverly. This was on Beverly Drive in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
And he says, look, there's your paintings. This is one of his family members said.
Right.
He goes, I didn't do that.
Yeah.
That's how it all started.
And so the DA ran sort of a sting on you. They eventually sort of, I don't know, got some information over wiretaps and stuff, and ultimately decided that you were an art forger. Is that correct? Is that sort of how that worked?
Right. Well, they got this art dealer and put a wire on him,
uh-huh.
and 25 of them came to my home.
25 of them being DA officers.
District attorney's officers. Yeah. Local cops, I guess, too. Everybody wanted a piece of it.
You did Chacall's. You did Caravaggio's. You did almost every major artist that we could think of, yes?
Anything I was asked to do except Jackson Pollock.
Except Jackson Pollock. Too difficult, yeah?
Too messy. Oh, too messy. Too sloppy.
How could you do Jackson Pollock?
But you would forge the paintings. You would forge the signatures. You would forge the provenance paperwork. You would
In some cases. Yeah. Not always.
The provenance.
It's just as difficult as a painting. In the past, nobody had to worry about the provenance. The provenance now is more important than the painting itself.
Yeah.
And as time goes by, it's going to be even more important.
What made you so good? What made you so successful at your job? Because you were living in a very nice community, in a nice home. You were driving 1, 2, maybe 3 cars. You were eating at some of the best restaurants in Los Angeles. What made you so good as an art forger for all those years?
Well, Scott, when you met me, was I living that way?
No, you were living in a motel next door to a restaurant bar in Newport Beach.
With a minivan with bird poop all over it.
Exactly, yeah. But what made you good before then, before you got arrested? What made you so talented?
Well, I think I'm a clinical perfectionist when it came to that. I love the aging part of it, the cracking part of it. The oohs and ahs that I got from the people who knew about art.
Mm-hmm.
Then that was it. I never signed anything my name. Here's something that people don't know is that they think I got a painting and copied it. I made paintings up in the style of artists.
Right.
A painting that never existed. I did that all the time except with lithographs and etchings.
And you would create sort of a story with a partner or somebody else where this painting was found, and it would sort of just come out of some travels in Europe?
No. That's what Hans von Meegeren would do that. I would, where did you get this? Oh, from a wealthy Italian family that wishes not to be known?
Uh-huh.
That's a wet dream. You know, that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
No, I had to have a solid certificates of authenticity from experts who know the artist, from stamps of authenticity from the estates, and the provenance is so important.
Right.
But even this is 25 years ago. Yeah. In April 18th, it'll be 25 years ago. I was arrested.
So I want to catch up here because that was 25 years ago. You eventually spent about 9 months in the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Station at San Dimas, kind of a work furlough program.
Buenos.
Huh?
A year, not 9 months. 3 months is a long time in the can. So it was a year.
All right. And you were teaching high school students, taggers, gangbangers, how to paint. That was basically your penance for the...
And paintings about traffic safety that I did in my
studio. My favorite, you did a Mona Lisa with a seatbelt on, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, because of people who couldn't speak English, they had to be visual. That was my Ferrari.
I love it.
So back on the art forgery, do you have any remorse for the people who you sort of snookered? Maybe you didn't snooker them, but the people who purchased what they thought were legitimate paintings and may find out one day that really they're copies done by Tony Tetro.
Yes, I do, but it didn't happen until recently.
What didn't happen until recently?
Any remorse.
Well, why recently? What transpired that made you more remorseful today?
During my trial, they had 5 years, 4.5 years the trial lasted.
Uh-huh.
And for 4.5 years, they put ads in the Los Angeles Times. I'm talking about the district attorney's office. Put ads in the Los Angeles Times, big block ads, trying to find one victim in my trial. They didn't have any victims. They didn't have anybody crying, look what I got. I paid a lot of money for this. They didn't have that. And so in my mind, so I didn't have any. So I had a hung jury because of it. So in my mind, I said, well, no victims, no harm. Well, everybody here, not see this program, American Greed.
Yeah, okay.
It's relatively, how old is that? 4 years old?
I don't know.
Well, I think that's an important program.
Okay.
Because it's the first time they've ever showed crime from a victim's point of view.
Okay. And it was that program that caused you to feel remorseful? Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
Well, really, because you see the repercussions of what you've done.
Right.
And so there's been no repercussions yet.
Right.
Maybe sometime in the future when they can find a way of finding my stuff. You see, I use the same paper that they use. I use the same pigments that they use.
The artist.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in that documentary, BBC, that you saw last night.
Right.
Did you see how they found a pigment that wasn't quite right?
Right.
It was too new for that Chagall.
Right.
Okay. Well, all my pigments were exactly the same as Chagall used.
Yeah.
The paper was exactly the same as Chagall used. Everything that I did was exactly the same. So it was going to be extremely difficult for them to say whether it was a Chagall or a me.
Do you buy into the quote that I read earlier that you're sort of a Frankenstein that went astray? You sort of have this genius type of attention to detail that makes you an expert art forger?
I was a perfectionist.
That's yeah.
A clinical perfectionist. Right. I mean, I liked it. It had to be just right.
Right.
On my Chagalls, there'd be lithographic ink has got a stain that that happens on the back for the tush, the ink, would... It's thick and greasy, and it was soaked through the paper. I would print the stain on the back of the paper. I would do everything. I would everything possible to make it just right. Right.
Tony, what was harder to get perfect, an old master like Chagall or more contemporary like a Jean Moreau?
They're all contemporary masters. An old master. When is an old master?
Well, a Rembrandt.
A Rembrandt. Of course, a Rembrandt's much more difficult.
Which did you enjoy doing more? The
old
Rembrandt?
Old master.
Was that the greatest challenge
soul.
For you? Yeah. Who's your favorite artist?
I was thinking about Bouguereau, the most difficult, the best flesh tones. The flesh tones are so real, they look photographic, even close up. But it's interesting, there's an article that I read, it's on artrenewal.org, that there was a World's Fair in 1900, and they asked Monet and they asked Degas, who in the year 2000 is going to be the most famous artist of this era, right now?
Right.
They both said Bouguereau.
Wow. Listening, by the way, you're listening to KIX 93.5, Laguna's only FM. This is Radio Caravan. In the studio is the world's greatest living art forger, Tony Tetro.
Not practicing.
I said living. I didn't say practicing.
Okay.
Yeah, but Tony, by the way, if you got a question out there, if there are listeners who are interested in asking Tony any particular questions about his lifestyle as an art forger, you can call 949-715-5936. 949-715-5936. And we're going to get Tony on the microphone here. Why is he off the microphone? Nice. And make sure you stay close on the microphone, Tony, for me. Tony, you and I met, I don't know how many years ago. You were living in a motel. You were basically...
You called it a motel.
It was a motel. It was two stories. It was right next door. And you kind of lived off, happy hour food at a local restaurant and stuff. But your life has dramatically changed since then, yes?
Much.
And, you seem to be sort of well taken care of these years. You have several cars we're going to talk about now. What does a reformed art forger do for a living today? And I want to start with the idea that you're emulating still famous mm-hmm. paintings for wealthy billionaire-type clients. Is that true?
Not emulating. Now I'm copying. Now, before I emulated.
What's the difference between emulating and copying?
Emulating is I emulated the style of an artist and signed their name. Now I copy a painting as close to exact as I can.
Okay.
And sign their name. And sign my name all over the back with stamps and everything. Because I have to. I'm ordered by the courts. In fact, I'm the only person in the United States that's ordered by the courts and has to.
That has to sign his name to back of everything you paint, right?
Yeah, I have to stamp that. I'm trying to find the right word that I usually use when I'm not on radio.
Yeah.
Stamp the hell out of it.
Yeah, but that's because they don't want anybody taking your paintings and passing them off as real.
Right.
They can't. By your signature on the back, nobody can do that.
So it can't get back into commerce as
real. Why would a wealthy billionaire client want you to come into his or her home and do these sorts of elaborate copying of famous artworks? Why? What's the purpose of that?
That's a good point. Now, it depends on the wealth. Oh, here's my coffee, and I didn't know it.
Don't spill. You're not supposed to have coffee in here, so we'll take that off the air. But go ahead and have a sip. Just don't spill it.
Sip my gluteus maximus. I'm going to have
it. Here we go. Nothing better than to hear somebody sip coffee over the radio, by the way.
Good
radio. Do you want another sip?
Good radio.
And that's another sip.
Where were we?
Why would a wealthy billionaire client ask you to come in and spend, I'm assuming, a lot of money to have you copy famous artworks?
Good question.
Thank you.
Depends on the clout you have, how much money you have, and if you can get away with it.
Okay.
Now think about this. Somebody living in tract homes has got a Rembrandt over their sofa. Who's going to buy it?
Right.
Okay. You get a billionaire.
Right.
And you've got a Rembrandt, Caravaggio, a Titian over their sofa, and it's cracked and it's aged and it's in a beautiful gold leaf frame. They're going to buy it. And everybody who's in his home is not going to know it's not in his home. Because a lot of these paintings, he chooses them.
Being one of your clients.
Yes.
Okay.
He sees that they're not in a museum, they're in a private collection.
Right.
So whose private collection? Because most often they say private collection. Sometimes they say the name of the person who owns it. But most often they say private collection.
Right.
Excuse me. You want me to bourbon this?
No, that's okay.
And so, yes, they do get away with it. So
it's just driven by ego.
Oh, yeah, tremendous ego.
You bring
ego.
The friends in the house, and you might not even mention that it's hanging on the wall. You just watch their eyes bulge out as they see a Rembrandt hanging over your fireplace.
But are there some clients who do it because they own the legitimate
yes.
painting, and then they use this to hang on the wall but put the legitimate one away in a vault?
I haven't done that in a long time, but that's what I used to do.
Yeah.
They would hang mine up, put the one in the vault, and save a lot of money on insurance. It's 5% annually to insure an old painting. Let's say you have a painting that's $100 million, which the ones that I paint would be worth at least $100 million.
Even though you're painting them, you're telling me? Oh, if they were legitimate, they would be worth that.
So that's a $5 million a year on one painting.
Right.
So, yes.
How much does a retired, reformed art forger earn ballpark to copy one of these now famous paintings for somebody's wall?
It depends on the degree of difficulty, the size, and how many people. So I'm not going to tell you.
Would 10,000, 100,000, 250,000? You would start at 10,000, yeah? And go up as high as 100,000?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Or more.
Or more. So as a retired, reformed art forger who's now copying famous paintings for wealthy clients, has this been sort of a rewarding now news second half career for you?
Yeah.
Yeah? Because you're driving around in how many cars these days?
Four.
You got four cars.
Well, it's, I'm not the only guy that has
I get
cars.
It. Robert's got more than four, I think. Huh? What kind of cars do you have?
I have one Mercedes and three Ferraris. Well, one I haven't seen. Does that matter?
What do you mean you haven't seen?
It's in England, and I bought it, and they won't let me bring it here.
Yeah. You drove the Ferrari today, right? It's downstairs.
Yeah.
Robert, you're a car guy, right?
Love cars.
I mean, these are not inexpensive cars.
Not at all. These are hundreds of thousands of dollars and up.
Pardon me?
They're hundreds of thousands of dollars and up.
Yeah.
Significantly up.
And to be clear, you've got three of them.
Now, why are the Brits keeping your car over there?
Well, there was an era here in the United States where there was more that you could do than not do. Now, there's more that you cannot do than you can do. I can't bring it over because of smog and for DOT, Department of Transportation, the bumpers, and this and that. But it's not just that I can get the bumpers on there. It's not just that I can smog it. I have to bring this up to 2014 standards. That means airbags, this, that, that. So there's only two companies in California that can do it, and it'd be over $2 million to have my car converted.
It's got to be a nice car.
Yeah, right.
Wow.
It's not going to happen.
What kind of car is it?
It's my dream car when I was a boy, a 1967 Ferrari P4, 330 P4. No, well, it's a replica. I have to make that perfectly clear. A real one would be worth between $60 and $80 million.
And what's this one worth?
$84,000,
yeah. Is it true that you forged a 1958 Ferrari?
57. It was 58. You got me on that one.
All right. What does that mean, you forged a Ferrari?
How do you drive a painting?
No, he didn't forge the painting. He forged the actual car.
I started with the taillights and went forward. And I had the schematics of the actual 58 Ferrari Testarossa 250 TR Testarossa, it's called. And there was only 29 of them, let me think about this, 19 of them made.
Yeah.
And one was missing. Serial number 28, 2898. I'm not sure the serial number right now. It's a long time ago.
How do you forge that car?
Well, I went to the best body man in the world. They call him the Cellini of body makers. His name was Scott Knight, and he pounded out a body. Each one of the bodies were slightly different because they were pounded out by hand in the 50s. And I went to Italy. I got the correct steering wheel that was indigenous to that car. I had the dashboard made. I had everything made exactly like the original.
What chassis did you use?
I started with a 250 GTE. Okay, but we completely bastardized that. It just followed the whole structure of the original 250 Testarossa. And I went all over looking just for the two-eared knockoff, because every knockoff was three-eared. I had to get the correct wheels. I'm a fanatic about that stuff.
Yeah. What happened to the car?
I sold it. I put an ad in Ferrari Owners magazines and
what did you sell it for? Do you remember?
Yeah. $310,000.
Wow.
And it was just
what was your investment in that?
More.
Really? Oh, okay.
It took 6 years to make.
Wow. Hey, I believe we have a caller online, if I'm not mistaken here. Caller, are you there?
I am. Good morning, Scott.
This must be my brother-in-law, Mark, from the East Coast. How are you, sir?
Doing just great. Thank you. Calling from Edisto Island, South Carolina.
That sounds beautiful. And you're on the beach just hanging out for the weekend, right?
Well, we had to get away from the snow, Scott.
Yeah. Hey, listen, you and I chatted about this particular show, and I asked you to come up with something sort of, you know, unusual to ask Tony. And you said to me last night that you had something good. What's your question for Tony Tetrault, the world's greatest living art forger by some people's standards?
And not practicing.
First of all,
I didn't say practicing. I said living.
You always said living. I heard that.
All right.
But I hope, Scott, you'll indulge me with more than just one question.
Well, let's go. Let's start with one.
Tony, I've got a question for you about your mother.
Okay.
Is it true that she once watched Amelia Earhart land her plane in their family's pasture?
How the hell?
Wow.
That's a fact. Yes. And she was just before she died, she was telling my daughter about it and us about it, and we thought she was going a little wacky, and it was a fact. We found out.
Did your mom know you were an art forger?
Yes, she went to my trial.
She went to your trial. And what was her sort of experience, or did she ever talk to you about sort of, you know, her son going to prison because he was an art forger? Did she ever talk about that with you?
Actually, she was getting old, and it was... she wasn't pleased with it.
Yeah.
But she was trying to support me, that's all.
That's good. Yeah, interesting. Mark, great question. You have a second one?
I do.
Okay.
That was a great question.
I actually got a third quick follow-up, but I've just got to ask this.
Please.
Tony, are any of the paintings that you've done more difficult than others from the standpoint of subtleties or details? I mean, I'm sure they are, but can you kind of give an example?
Okay. If you look at a Chagall and you look at... a Bouguereau. Well, let's say not many people know who Bouguereau is. Let's say Rembrandt. There's little subtleties in both that a Chagall looks much more simple than it would be a Rembrandt. Like, look at the face on a Chagall. He does a little scribble, but the scribble for the face is a Chagall face. And you've got to manage that little scribble to make it a Chagall face. It's got to be Chagall-ish. And the colors. The colors got to be perfect. Whereas in a Rembrandt, in an oil, you've got to get the feeling of Rembrandt. He would put the paint on fast, and he would capture the person and soul, and he'd have so much texture, you'd have to get that just right. Where can I see? I did a drawing, a Rembrandt drawing, and I have it. I have my phone. I can show it.
We won't be able to see it on camera. But in fact, I do have one of your paintings. Let's go to segue just a little bit here. Mm-hmm. What is this that we're looking at? I'm going to lift it up for the cameras, and this thing's framed.
It's heavy.
And it's heavy. What are we looking at here?
Leonardo only painted on wood. That's a discussion people don't know about.
Okay.
Because in the Louvre, they've got one on canvas.
Right.
They literally cut the wood away and put it back on canvas. Restorers did 100 years ago. They will not do that anymore.
You did this painting.
Yes.
You did this how long ago?
I finished it just about when the BBC was over there.
Okay, we'll talk
six
about
months ago.
For our listeners, this is mother and child, but it has an odd twist because between them is a vicious small panther about ready to eat the child.
Right, but that's my only twist on a Leonardo.
That was a tip. It might be a fake, by the way.
Well, what's it? Not only, wait a minute, it's missing.
Everyone else knows that he used snow leopards to eat his children.
What's the purpose of this painting, Tony? Why did you create this particular painting?
Working on a novel with a professor of literature from Orange Coast University.
I don't know.
Chapman University, whatever. He doesn't talk about it. He's retired. But anyway, that's a Da Vinci that they know he may have painted or did paint.
Right.
And that's logical that if it was a panther, that it would be heresy and it would be destroyed or covered up. If I had it here to look at, I could describe it.
Right.
Why I did it. But it's not here. They took it away. See, it's not here anymore.
Yeah, I know that. Okay.
So,
but, I mean, you created this painting for what purpose, I guess, is what I'm asking.
For the book.
I see. Because you're writing a book.
Right, we are. It's Gary Delph and I.
Okay.
Yes. But we're sort of illustrating the book with different, like, 50 photographs and paintings.
Gotcha.
But that is interesting. Now, Leonardo did three drawings of, it's called Madonna and Cat.
Right.
Now, that's a baby panther cub. That's the difference. And that would have been heresy because everybody knew the story, and it's a biblical story.
Yeah. Hey, also as a reformed art forger, you're now becoming sort of the art forgery expert for certain TV shows. Mm-hmm. And I think it was last year on CNBC. Do I have those call letters correct, Tony?
Yes, you do.
There was the TV show Treasure Detective, in which you appeared as an art forgery expert. And then just this past week, the BBC One TV show Fake or Fortune, where they brought to you a Chagall, and you're sort of an expert in Chagall, Mark Chagall. They brought you a Chagall to determine your opinion on whether it was real or fake, because they weren't sure, correct?
Correct.
In your opinion, the Chagall they showed on this BBC TV show, was it real or was it fake and why?
When they brought it in, I said instantly it was fake, and they go, cut, cut, cut. You know, they wanted more drama. it was fake. It was good. It was.
How did you know it was fake?
The face and the lines around the body of it was a nude. Yeah, this on radio you can't see the picture, so, and the signature, the whole composition just wasn't Chagall to me. But it was 1910. I never went back that far.
Yeah,
fortunately. But I did it.
You sort of know Chagall pretty well. Have you ever been in a museum where you saw one of your paintings hanging there?
Yes. And now, Scott, you're going to ask me the next following question. Where, when, who is? And I'm going to tell you. I'm not going to tell you.
Why wouldn't you tell somebody? Wouldn't that be the greatest story of an art forger's world that, by the way, here in ABC Museum is hanging one of my paintings that they think is real. Wouldn't that really sort of solidify you in the art forgery world as one of the greatest?
I'm as solidified as I want to be. I don't care if they want to call me the greatest or the worst. There's no way I'm going to open up a can of worms and cause my life misery and tell anybody anything anymore about that. I don't want to know anything anymore. But it is kind of cool to walk in and see something there.
So when is your book coming out?
I've just recently got a lot of offers, cherry picking.
You know, it would be funny if you wrote it and somebody accused you of plagiarism.
that would be
a fun trial.
Hey, Tony,
I would never do anything like that.
Well,
I have a couple convictions that you did.
All right, we're listening to Cakes 93.5, Laguna's only FM. This, of course, is Radio Caravan. In the studio is Tony Tetro, the world's greatest living, not practicing, art forger. How'd I do on that?
Very good.
Very nice. Last year, there was something called the Art Series Hotel Contest in Australia titled Can You Spot the Fake Warhol? And this group apparently flew you over to Australia to participate in this program where you forged, for the public view, Andy Warhol's.
Mm-hmm.
What was that all about?
Well, they asked me, and they gave me a lot of money.
Yeah.
And they flew me over on an A380, and I had my own bedroom. Uh-huh. which was nice because it's a 16-hour flight.
Okay.
And I had
I don't want to hear about the bedroom necessarily. Tell me about the content.
I do.
We got 4 minutes, so I want to get through some stuff.
There's also, in conjunction with a forum on ArtForger, and I was the only artist there.
Okay.
So it was very clever, and they put me together with this, and they had all these art experts from all over the world.
Yeah.
And I was persona non grata to them, and they had a forum about art forgery.
Yeah.
And the damage that it does. And so they were asking questions, and what it ended up doing is making me a lot more money because I got commissions off of it.
Oh, you did. So people kind of like the idea that you're copying these famous paintings, contact you to have paintings for themselves, yes?
Well, not only that, there was about 17 art experts there from all over. And I got 35 interviews after. They got none.
Wow.
Wow.
So the public obviously likes the bad guy.
What did you think of Warhol as an artist?
Not much, but I liked him.
Yeah. You kind of refer to some artists as ham and eggers, yes? Was Warhol a ham and egger?
No, he was far from a ham and egger.
Oh, okay.
He was more of a tomato super.
He was far from a ham and egger.
Yeah.
But what I liked about Andy Warhol was his wit. He knew exactly what he was. He is more surprised than anybody at the success of Warhol.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what a ham and egger is. Norman Rockwell, I think, was the greatest American artist living. Yeah. And his art was not accepted at Sotheby's or Christie's.
Yeah.
Now he's been rediscovered for some reason, and now they're worth fortunes where they weren't worth anything during my era.
So lastly, we got 3 minutes left here, Robert, and I want you to see this. Tony has decided to take this genius, this Frankensteinian, I don't even know if that's a legitimate word or not, this style of his to create high-end luxury watches. And you brought this, Tony. I want you to kind of take this with you here. And in a minute or less, tell us what's going on with these watches because we don't have a lot of time. And I know we got another caller on the phone named Larry. Larry, while he's pulling up the watches, Larry, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. You've been listening to the show, yes?
Absolutely.
You got a question for Tony Tetro.
Yeah, Tony, do you have any original pieces out that you've gotten that are out in a gallery, or is it all just a copy or a forgery?
Great question.
It is. All copies and forgeries. Yes, copies, they would be lithographs in the etchings or forgeries, but I didn't put them there.
Why didn't you never create your own original artwork?
Because I, at the time, enjoyed what I was doing.
You enjoyed the art forgery aspect of the art world, not the actual creating original side of it, yeah? Let's talk about the watches. We got 1 minute, Tony. I'm sorry, we cut you off show.
No, I don't care.
Case of 10 beautiful watches here. Those are stunning.
Well, yeah, I'm making watches now, and I'm in the process of making the world's thinnest mechanical watch and the thinnest automatic watches in the world.
Yeah.
Thin watches are coming back after a hiatus of like 17 years. For the last 17 years, a watch is like a hamburger on your wrist, but to me, it's going to be thin again.
What's the name of that line, Tony?
Antonio Tetro.
And you got paintings, really sort of detailed paintings on the back of some of these of famous artists?
Yes.
You're using mechanical devices that are really high-end that you're purchasing overseas. You've been working on this for 2 years now.
About five years.
How soon until you're ready to launch this particular high-end luxury watch business?
I ran out of Michelangelo's paintings, and this is the only one that doesn't have it. I'll give you one here.
How long until you think they'll be available? Any ideas?
3 months.
You think 3 months they'll be available? Yeah. What will these watches sell for? We got about 30 seconds or less.
20,000 and up.
And why 20,000? Because they come from you?
Because they're high end.
Mm-hmm.
No, not because they're coming from me, because they're going to be precious metals.
Okay.
And they're difficult to make.
Yeah.
And they're very expensive movements.
And we're going to get some B-roll on that. And I'm getting the wrap-up sign here. So, Tony, always interesting to chat with you, man. And, you know, the funny thing, real quickly here, Tony, we were sitting one day on a patio having drinks and stuff, and I said, Tony, can you answer one question for me honestly? And he says, I can do that. And I said,
I can do that.
And I looked him right in the eye, and I said, Tony, do you ever BS me? when you're telling your stories. And he throws up his arms and he gives me this big hearty laugh and he says, of course I do.
That's what I do.
That's part of his charm. Hey, you've been listening to KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. This is Radio Caravan. I'm Scott Hayes.
Robert Palmer, and we'll see you next week.
Beautiful. Take us out of here, Brian.
You've been listening to Radio Caravan with Scott Hayes and Robert Palmer and reporter Megan Jamerson.